Keep in touch with the Wolf Connection Podcast on our Instagram handle at the Wolf Connection Pod, or email us your questions, comments, and guest ideas to podcast@wolfconnection.org. Thank you for your support, and howls to you all. Welcome to the Wolf Connection Podcast. I'm your host, John Calvin. All right, so a individual that we've had on before, a former friend, and she, just to give rundown some of her many things that she has, she's a PhD in wildlife management from Michigan State, a master's of animal behavior and ecology from Notre Dame, a bachelor's of geography and environmental science from Valparaiso. She's coming to us from outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico. She is now one of the co-executive directors for Wildlife for All, Michelle Lute. Michelle, it's great to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you for accepting the invitation to come back on again. I know you're busy. I know you and Kevin Bixby, the other co-executive director, really looks like you're reforming or rebranding or just really trying to do a lot of things for Wildlife for All. So just, I guess right off the bat, tell everybody, because when we were in Yellowstone, when we were talking just before with you, there were a bunch of people there who had mentioned Dave Stalling is working. I think he's part of the advisory board for Wildlife for All. There were people there who were very excited that you took the position as co-ED. So there was a lot of chatter about this organization there. So just give everyone an idea of what's the mission for Wildlife for All and what's your role right now as co-ED as you step into this sort of fresh-faced.
Sure. Yeah. So Wildlife for All is a sort of refocused mission of Kevin Bixby's original nonprofit organization called the Southwest Environmental Center. So that organization goes back to 1991, I believe, and has been repurposed. And now we're doing business as Wildlife for All with this really focused mission of making state wildlife governance democratic, just, compassionate, and focused on ecological health. And this really came out of his experience, but also the experience that I've had through my career. And I think a lot of conservation advocates have started to realize that we're often chasing the symptoms of a really systemic foundational problem, which is the fact that state wildlife agencies don't really do wildlife conservation. Is a client-based model of serving hunters and anglers, their traditional clientele, which was great for a while, and that did result in some great conservation. But what we're seeing is that, you know, 100 years of this model, what's often referred to as the North American model of wildlife management that states often offer, into the mess that we're in. It's, you know, resulted in the biodiversity crisis and the lack of response to it. So what we're really focused on is making this process democratic. And that's because wildlife is held in the public trust for everybody. And so they should have their own decisions. We want it to be just because wild animals deserve to be treated fairly. And also because humans deserve a voice in this process. We want it to be compassionate because the public values are growing to understand that wild animals are sentient beings worthy of empathy and respect, and their welfare and well-being is important. And then, of course, we're hoping that we can convince state agencies to actually focus on ecological health and the whole value of ecosystems functioning healthy as they should. So there's an urgent need, as we see the biodiversity and global extinction crisis and climate crisis that's all tied in. We need to be doing a lot more, not just, you know, growing mule deer and elk for folks to hunt.
You think as we add new groups to the table of this discussion of, you know, the North American wildlife management system, is it going to be required that we justify using monetary value, why those groups are coming to the table? Is that going to be a necessary part of the process?
It's definitely a part of the conversation. It's not the only part. So traditionally, folks have offered the idea that, well, hunters and anglers get a bigger piece of the bigger access, basically, to the decision-making table because they pay for conservation. And that's actually non-consumptive users or the general public are contributing quite a bit, sometimes the majority of funds to conservation overall. So who pays does matter, in part because there's this mythology that the public and other wildlife stakeholders don't pay when they actually do. So that's part of money does still matter, and it speaks, and there's few conservation dollars to go around. So it is an important and realistic part of the puzzle. But, you know, we don't want to take that too far, because obviously nature has its own intrinsic value, and we've got to recognize that. So it doesn't all come down to dollars and cents.
Can you share in the ways, just because I think you're right, a lot of folks do think that non-consumptive users don't generally, they don't have a very clear pathway to fund conservation, but how do they?
Sure. Yeah. So, well, they contribute to nonprofit organizations. There are general funds that end up going into management that does a lot of the wildlife conservation that happens in this country. And then, you know, the federal excise dollars, the Pittman-Robertson dollars and the Dingell-Johnson dollars, are excise taxes on certain guns, ammunition, equipment, even motorboat fuel, small engine fuel, fishing tackle, even tariffs on yachts and fishing equipment. So a lot of that's not just hunters and anglers. You know, there's lots of people who are purchasing motorboat fuel. Most people purchasing guns in are not for primarily for hunting. So lots of folks are even contributing through that pot of money, which often gets thought of as really just hunter angler money, and it's not.
Last one, John, and then you can move on. What do you think about the term, as you're saying the word non-consumptive, what do you think about the word non-consumptive? Is it at all like something that we have to think about that word too? Because I think that mountain bikers, hikers, and other people we consider to be non-consumptive users, which, you know, I'm an avid hiker, avid backpacker, we're definitely out in the woods in higher numbers doing those activities, displacing wildlife, et cetera, et cetera. How do we talk about that term and how that kind of plays a part in this idea that hunters and fish and anglers are consumptive and mountain bikers and hikers in the millions are not?
Oh gosh, that's such a good question, and something that I don't think gets considered often enough. I mean, I think we're starting to ask this question more because we're loving our public lands to death in a lot of places, and really impacting wild nature just by biking or even being on foot and talking. You know, there's studies showing that mountain lions and bears will move off their kills just by hearing human voices. So, you know, we're letting our I have three rescue dogs, so no judgment, but, you know, we're letting, you know, dogs roam around, and they have an impact on wildlife unless they're under voice control or on leash. So, I mean, there's just so many impacts that people aren't thinking about that we need to consider. So it's a great point. You know, consumptive use versus non-consumptive, a really wonky term that's kind of strange to use. And we should probably be thinking about better, more intuitive ways to talk about this. But yeah, absolutely. I think it's an important part that we're all having an impact, and we've got to mitigate our impact. So it's not just about, you know, considering the impacts of hunting and contributing.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And those were great points, Stephen, because a lot of this came up again when we were at the summit, and and you even say on the website for Wildlife for All, a lot of these policies, a lot of these institutions, a lot of the thinking, like you guys were just saying about non-consumptive, a lot of this goes back a century or more, just about the way that terminology is used, the way that organizations are using the money, the way that the North America model has, I think in the beginning, I remember speaking to Dave Stalling about this, in that he goes, if you follow the pillars of the model to the way they're supposed to be followed, it actually isn't a terrible way to do it, but obviously those pillars haven't been followed
per usual.
As you know, Michelle, you've laid out, and any number of people have been laying this out, and you're right. It's, you know, when you look at when we spoke to Matt Yamashita for Colorado Parks and Wildlife, when they're about to release wolves, the non-consumptive community came up about this very issue, about a lot of hikers, a lot of mountain bikers, a lot of the impact there. Many people, I think, don't understand what you're doing, and that both of you said that perfectly. You know, the animals, especially the predators, are evading. They're just going to go off their kills. They're not going to go on the same trails that they know to they're used to. And so we're impacting things in a different way as opposed. And I think that's where hunters and anglers, most of them, I think are good individuals. They get the bad rap because we see they're actually hunting and killing or angling. And so we see that, and then we don't see those impacts.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's why we're arguing for a democratic process. Everybody deserves a voice. Yeah. Hunters and anglers deserve a voice, but there's other folks that deserve a voice, and we should all be contributing equally to conservation because we all benefit equally. So yeah, it's about equality and equity and the whole process. It's such an important part of it. And this, you know, this is no different.
Yeah. When you look at things that you're seeing, let's say Colorado, for instance, where they're doing the license plate, the wolf license plate. So that's something that that's going to roll right back into non-lethal methods for the individuals who are on the Western Slope, who actually have to deal with wolves. So it's something where the Front Range is trying to help the Western Slope. Are there other, are there tools that you, what are things that Wildlife for All is sort of looking at? I know Kim Bean and Mark Cook have talked about the wolf stamp for a long time, or the stamp, like when you get your national park season pass or whatever, it's an extra, whatever, 30 something bucks. Mm-hmm. And it's, or whatever it may be. What are there any things that you guys are looking into? I'm sure that's part of the process. I just don't know where that would fall in your, the four pillars there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great question. You know, we argue for diversified funding on all fronts because we see that there are more conservation dollars to capture by some of these, I was going to say unique, but they're not stamps or license plates. We've been doing that sort of thing for a long time. And the case of Colorado, I don't remember the numbers, but it shows, I think the potential for the revenue is pretty large. So there's lots more ideas like that out there. There's the model like PetSmart does of rounding up a few dollars. Lots of companies do this. You round up a few dollars when you check out. That pot of money can add up to be really huge. A really huge revenue source for conservation, and people are willing to support conservation. So if folks, you know, at Patagonia or REI were willing to do that, that would be huge. So that very early stages of how would this work, how much money could be brought in, and, you know, what are the barriers to implementing something like that? In the past, people have proposed backpack taxes and that sort of thing. That's been defeated every time, in part because certain interests that want a stranglehold on the decision-making process want to continue to use that point that, oh, hunters and anglers are paying for conservation. They've fought those efforts. But, you know, taxes are also unpopular on lots of fronts. So I think the more voluntary spending options and donation options are the way to go. And then there's RAWA, which would be a huge pot of money for states to use towards species of conservation concern. So not just game species, but it would be a huge pot of money. So RAWA is Recovering America's Wildlife Act. It's been proposed a couple times, just got reintroduced this year by Senator Heinrich and Tillis. So it's got bipartisan support. And the question, the sticking point has been where this money is going to come from. But if they figure it out and they think they're getting closer to answering this question, the funding is going to ramp up until fiscal year 2027 in $1.3 million every year for conservation, which would be huge.
Can you elaborate on the word, well, can you elaborate on the importance of the word compassionate in the context of the Wildlife for All mission statement? Not because the word compassion is confusing to anyone in a, seems more of a foreign word to the process of politics and regulations. How do you integrate, this like human compassion element into things like regulations and wildlife management?
Yeah, that's such a good question. It's not something that we've done a whole lot, at least not in the sphere of animals. But what we're recognizing, you know, as a society as a whole, is that this old notion that really conservation is just about populations or species and not about individuals or families is really an inaccurate focus. So that's the old thought that biology is just about populations. And we're just trying to prevent species from going extinct. Yeah. But now we're seeing, even in science, an understanding that the social dynamics at, say, the pack structure of wolves is super important. So being compassionate and thinking about the family dynamics helps species, helps reduce conflict. You know, I was so excited when the Cassidy et al. Paper came out. I guess this was late last year that it came out, showing that pack persistence and pup survival goes down after a pack loses even a member. Right. And so, right. I mean, think about what's happened outside of Yellowstone National Park in the Northern Rockies and the, you know, egregious slaughter of wolves across that expanse. Now, the state agencies are going to say, well, we're still going to keep our cap of, you know, 300, 500 wolves. They won't go extinct even if we're close to 30% of their population. But we're not considering the family dynamics and how those things can compound and aggravate an already changing system. And it, you know, it lays bare this idea that family dynamics matter, essentially. One part, that's just the biology. There's also the moral and ethical side of these considerations. And society as a whole sees animals as individuals, sentient beings worthy of their own existence and having intrinsic value, meaning that they have the right to exist beyond their use to anybody else. Well, society is expanding the moral community to include not just humans. And, you know, for a long time, we weren't good at even including all humans, right? We're still figuring that out, but we're right. Expanding that moral community. Now we're seeing animals as, you know, contributing to the needs of, you know, higher order values. Think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, belongingness, connection, those sort of things. Animals are a part of the family and the moral community, and our policies need to reflect that and be compassionate.
Yeah, 100%. It definitely does. What's the when Kevin started this, was this his initial route that he was going to go this way? And I think it's a wonderful way to go, because it seems as though, again, this was stuff discussed when we were in Yellowstone, that a lot of the tactics that have been used, whether it's conservation, ecology, science, a lot of this wasn't really, it was hitting, but it was more excuse me, like the shock value is sort of lessening, and that it's not really hitting the point. Like Kim and Mark for Wolves of the Rockies, they go and they fight the legislative battle, which is really where these things are going to be won or lost in terms of making a difference. That's how they got the quotas, not Kim and Mark specifically, but the quotas in Northern Yellowstone got down from, I think it was unlimited or 25 to down to 6. So is this something when Kevin started that it was about state wildlife reform initially, or is it sort of evolving into that mission with you there co-EDing with him?
You know, by the time he was creating Wildlife for All, it had really coalesced in his mind. And I don't want to speak too much for him, but we've talked about it quite a bit and bonded over this experience of realizing the fundamental systemic work that's so hard to do. But everybody's talking about governance reform, but understandably, and I've been one of these people, we've all been focused on this sort of triage mode, this kind of whack-a-mole of let's just put out the most immediate fire. And I mean, there's just so many examples with wolf conservation country. It's just, you know, you could have all conservation organizations all hands on deck all the time trying to fix a wolf problem. But you know, it's a really illustrative example of why we need to do the foundational work first, or in tandem with these litigation or legislative efforts. So I think what Kevin saw over the course of his decades working in conservation, some really great wins. You know, he talks about banning the wildlife killing contests in New Mexico as one of the huge victories in his career. Similar things like that. You know, I helped with that effort. I helped with Roxie's Law to ban traps, poisons, and snares in New Mexico on public lands. You know, one of the biggest joys of my career was stopping the egregious planned second hunt in Wisconsin of wolves that had slaughtered their population within 3 days earlier that year. And that's just one season, right? And so you have to bring that litigation again, potentially every season that's proposed for wolves in every state. The same thing, traps are allowed in most places across the US. So you got to fight that battle over 10 years. It took 10 years of dedicated grassroots action in New Mexico to get traps, poisons, and snares banned. Things like sodium cyanide bombs that the federal government puts out, you know, that should be low-hanging fruit, but it's not. It's hard. But if in tandem with all of that great work, we're also thinking about the systemic problems, we're setting ourselves up for success. So the next time wolves outside of the Northern Rockies are delisted from the Endangered Species Act, we've got a better state wildlife agency that's going to listen to the public a little bit better, maybe listen to the science a little bit better, and make better policy decisions. That's what we're fighting for.
And how is Wildlife for All going to tackle that? Because we keep mentioning the Northern Rockies. We all know that Montana, Idaho, Wyoming, those are the three states that really are targeting predators more so than any other state, I think, group of states. I mean, again, you did some fantastic work in New Mexico, and we spoke about that earlier when we had you on, I believe it was almost a year ago. And so how do you take that, those lessons you learned and Kevin's learned from banning those contests into an arena really like the Northern Rockies, where it's wolves, it's bears, mountain lions to an extent, because there are places, I believe, in Utah, Nevada, I think it's Utah, where they want to have mountain lion hunts, and they're at a fairly low number. So what's the strategy there for, as you say, if you want to build the foundation up, how is that going to happen when there is such opposition in those state houses and they meet every 2 years, and so you're sort of locked in and you have a finite amount of time to get something done?
It's such a tough nut to crack. But, you know, we're starting with a couple foundational things. So, you know, it might not, but changing the narrative through public outreach and education, addressing these, you know, mythologies around the North American model of wildlife management, addressing these notions that hunting is conservation by changing the narrative is going to be super important. And really long-term work. That's not we don't have a concrete win to show you next year. But and we're already seeing this in the Northern Rockies and other places, when you start seeing your points echoed in the broad public discourse of these issues, you know you're starting to make some headway. The question whether or not hunters are the only stakeholders at the table, that's, you know, making some headway. When conservation groups get a seat at the table, and, you know, non-traditional voices are heard, when tribes are being brought in as sovereign nation with true consultation, all of that is getting towards the democratic process that we're hoping for. And we're seeing that here and there. But, you know, some of what we want to see in other states that have a little bit more promise outside of the Northern Rockies are things like better appointments to the commission. Now that's done by the governor in almost every state. And so we're not really an avenue right now that we can pursue in the Northern Rockies. So right now it's about public education and outreach, and it's about pushing for democratic process.
I want to touch on something else too, that because you guys talked about, you and Stephen were touching on it with the paper that was put out about wolves and the family dynamics. I just finished reading Brad Orsted's book, and he's obviously a big bear enthusiast and advocate. And it speaks to the same thing, where he was talking about two cubs, or three cubs actually, that were orphaned by, you know, an elk hunter that shot a mama grizzly who basically was just looking up out of the tall grass to see what was going on. The hunter got scared, shot the bear. And then these three cubs that are under 3 months old are now left, you know, and essentially what happens at that point are the bears, I think the state agency usually takes them in and they euthanize them because they can't survive, or they'll become trouble bears. And this, I guess, will speak to the ecological health. I mean, that's what you guys are also pushing for. Is it mostly predator based, or is it, well, I'm sure it's all forms of ecological health, but does it start with that? Like you were saying, the wolf pack, I'm sure the grizzly family, mountain lions, making sure that they're able to do what they need to do. Where does it start for you guys at Wildlife for All in terms of ecological health? Or is it literally from the rivers and streams and from the ground up? How do you guys deal with that?
My answer to this question is both. My answer to most questions that people expect yes or no or one or the other is it's probably both. It's not a cop out, honestly.
No,
it's got to be bottom up, and it's got predators so important to the trophic cascades that we would see in many more places if we weren't exploiting their populations. So important to the ecological health. But so are invertebrates, so are pollinators, so are the once abundant species of birds now declining that used to be spreading seeds and helping habitat regenerate. You know, it's everything and all of it in between. And so I can't really choose one or the other. They're so important. And that's why we, you know, one of the fundamental pieces of for is to give state agencies actual authority to conserve all of those species. So in New Mexico, it's very limited authority for the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish to even protect invertebrates or species outside of that are not game species, essentially. So any legislation that we push for or any sort of reform efforts is just expanding that authority. And that reminds me of the other point I was going to make about an opportunity in the Northern Rockies and everywhere is, again, recovering America's Wildlife Act. Now, if that gets passed and states money in the federal decision-making process and then each state's decision-making process, there will be an ability to advocate strongly for funding that goes to species of greatest conservation need and expanding the authority so that we're protecting everything from wolves to invertebrates.
Is that the same? So if that, is that up for, I guess, vote this time around? Is there any update on that in terms of, I know it's great that it's bipartisan for one, and two, I guess, is it coming up in the Congress and the Senate? Do you know where that sort of sits at this moment?
Heard much chatter about any hearings recently, so I'm not really sure where it's at. It's, again, I think they're still trying to kind of, the devil is in the details and figuring out that funding question. That's the latest that I've heard.
Right. And then when we're looking at the issues or some of the issues that we're talking about with state wildlife management, obviously we're talking about the policies, and that's the big thing. How do you go about, I don't want to use the word change, but how do you try to make the perception towards, I guess, carnivores a little less hostile? Because I know that's one of the things that you guys have as one of the ways to mitigate this problem. It seems, and we just had an individual who was on our podcast last week, who he grew up, he was a fifth, sixth generation Montanan. He was brought up to dislike wolves very, very much. And then on his own volition, you know, learned about OR54, started studying wolves, and now all of a sudden he wants to be a wolf biologist. He's trying to change minds in that way. So those stories are wonderful and powerful, but how do we change consensus about carnivores in general so that we understand that we can coexist and also understand that they are a huge part of the ecology of all these wild spaces that we have, so that hunters and anglers and everybody can sort of get on board with the mission of what you all are trying to do?
Such a huge question. And you kind of noted part of my answer, which is good storytelling. And that doesn't mean just making up stories. That means, you know, translating the science into good storytelling where people can relate to, you know, the wild dramas that are playing. When people find out about how far wolves can travel in search of a new territory and a mate, you know, that I think stirs some empathy and some understanding of what animals are going through. And people can relate to those stories because they've traveled vast distances and journeys to overcome a challenge or to move to a new place and start a job. You know, there's relating on those levels is super important, and the science and the data backs that up. So I'm still a fan of scientific inquiry, and the more that we ask good questions about the complex lives of animals, the better that we can understand them. And I just have to put a plug in. I'm finishing Ed Yong's book, An Immense World. Probably a lot of folks have already heard it. I think it's pretty popular. But I mean, just understanding the way that animals perceive their world in these ways that we had no idea, you know, our own kind of human-centered lens about, you know, the colors in the rainbow and how that actually is very different among different animals. I think that scientific inquiry and those good questions, and again, like the Cassidy et al. Paper and understanding pack dynamics in wolves, also super. And then finding those few rare examples where we've got predator populations that are not exploited, and seeing what kind of stable dynamics, seeing what kind of ecological health and diversity happens in those places. Those are few and far between, but the more we tell those stories and we provide a positive vision of the future, it's not all doomsday, which I'm super guilty of. I'm total Debbie Downer. I mean, I was thinking the other day, like, how often do I say the word crisis nowadays? I wish I had like a Google word search of just my own language around the word crisis, because I'm sure it's just like totally spiked in the last 5 years. I'm like, I'm challenged to say that. And of course, I've totally violated it in this interview today. I've totally blown my quota for the month probably. But again, you know, environmentalists are seen as taking away tools. And I think we need to be, you know, providing that positive vision and talking about the tools that do exist. And that's another realm of science. We're showing how well non-lethal tools work if you implement them right in the right context. So providing more tools, providing good stories and a positive vision of how to move forward, I think is the only way to do it. And that sounds more kumbaya than I often feel, but I think that's the long observation is to find those solutions and be good storytellers. And I'm going to say it, collaborate. You know, that's a dirty word in a lot of circles that I'm in terms of kind of the left-leaning progressive environmental movement. I say the word collaborate and people are like, oh, but all of these examples has not worked and eroded a good conservation outcomes. But again, I think if we're solution oriented and we look at, okay, non-lethal tools work to prevent conflict between wolves and livestock, let's focus on that for a while, because, you know, I'd like to see cows off public lands just as much as the next, but we're not there yet. So we got to kind of figure out ways to collaborate, and that's hard. So is democracy. It's messy. It's not always going to be perfect, but we got to stick to our ideals while still being pragmatic.
It seems like you were at the summit, because this was a lot of the, this was like day two, basically the end of day three, where it was essentially what you just said in less words, but it was this realization. And it seems as though a lot of groups are coming to this realization about collaboration, about talking and talking, not talking at people, but talking with people. And this is the only way to really get out of these messes that have been created over decades and a century, and just the amount of work that has to go to pick every piece out of this and say, okay, we're going to go through this piece. And once we get through that, then that'll lead us to this piece, and not in a malicious, angry way, because obviously that does nothing but have other people dig heels in on either side, and then we get nowhere. And then that divide grows. And it was something when Steve and I were interviewing Garrick Dutcher there from Living with Wolves, he said something to the effect that we want to dissolve the aisle in the middle. There shouldn't be a middle or an aisle. In other words, or a line that separates one side and the other. We should really all be able to coalesce and figure this out together. And that's a really powerful statement from someone whose family has been championing wolves for a very, very long time. And it's not just him. There are other folks, obviously, that are starting to catch on with this concept. And it's great that you guys are obviously also at the forefront of understanding all of these different things have to be done in a collaborative sense. Is this, I know with your former work, you did a lot of wonderful, amazing things. Do you feel like right now where you are with Wildlife for All, I know you're still getting your feet wet, but all of the academia work that you've done, do you feel like this is something where you can pull from every single aspect that you've done? Because just looking at your resume in that way, it seems as though this is the perfect fit for you.
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate you know, kind of my thought as I learned more about what Wildlife for All was doing. I really thought like, this is the coalescing of my, you know, advocacy experience and my academic work. So to back up a little bit, some of my research was animal behavior and ecology. I chased monkeys around Southeast Asia for my master's. And then I made the jump from non-human primates to human primates to understand how to address conflict with carnivores. You know, I wanted to study wolves, but I realized, okay, you know, and this is the age old tells you nowadays, you know, I got into wolf management because it's awesome. And I realized I just have to figure out people. And that's basically the journey of my PhD dissertation was to realize if I want to address human wildlife conflict, it's really about addressing human human conflict over wildlife. So I was looking at governance. I was trying to understand, you know, Eleanor Ostrom's, you know, Tragedy of the Commons and how to govern a common good is sort of how she talked about it. And I was also using social psychology to understand what gets in the way of these policy processes and why do we fight? Well, it's this age-old social identity that started, you know, through tribalism, where you're competing for resources, natural resources, access to land. We're now competing for resources like, well, it's still access to land and wildlife, but it's also access to power structures. And so when there's a perceived competition between, and we all identify with various different groups, that creates this conflict. And the way to overcome social identity conflict is to create a common group, a common sense of purpose. And so that's why I think broadening the sphere of conservation, broadening the definition that brings everybody in is going to be key to collaboration. Conservation isn't just hunting. That might be a part of it in some places, but conservation is also addressing the biodiversity crisis. There, I did it again with crisis. Dang it.
It's your next tattoo.
Addressing the challenges, you know.
There you go.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. I believe exactly what you said is true about what really causes these issues. That's why collaboration really is the key, because it really is what we're talking about is trying to find some kind of common ground that we can all move forward with. But I think, and it always work, right? I mean, nothing always works. That's why we're where we are, right? We've tried a lot of things. Nothing always works. And I think sometimes the word collaboration, part of the reason it doesn't always work is because sometimes the word collaboration, what people really mean is we need to talk to the other side and convince them to see it our way. And then we can have the freedom to make the world look the way that we want. Perspective. But in reality, it needs to be honest, right? When you say collaborate or find common ground, it needs to be honest. And that's what I love about when John and I started this podcast is we said those words and I think we really meant it and we still mean it and we're still trying to facilitate that all the time. And it seems to really be the best form of this topic. And we don't all agree, but the only way anything will not only work, but work and not also create a social war at the same time, which we don't need any more of, is for us to do it together, regardless of how hard it is to talk with folks who adamantly disagree with us. I mean, great, good point.
I remember this because I have very strong ideals. And so when the rubber meets the road, there are some value-based conflicts that are really entrenched and hard to get past. You know, if one side really doesn't want to see any killing of wolves and the other side really cannot let go of a potential option, where's the compromise, you know, there isn't. So, you know, there's all this literature in the social sciences about good process will lead to acceptance of the policy outcomes, but there is some limit to that. And that again gets at where democracy is super messy. We still have to get good process and we're so far from that. So I think it's like, let's actually have a democratic process first and see where that gets us. But you're going to have collaboration because otherwise you're switching from a tyranny of the minority to a tyranny of the majority, right? So
exactly.
Right now,
yep.
Tyranny of the minority, where a particular interest, hunters and anglers, which are a very small percentage, something like 4.6% of the U.S. population are hunters right now, and they're still driving. They have this outsized impact on wildlife policy, right? So you got a tyranny of the minority. But if you made it just, you know, disparagingly call ballot box biology, where it's just a, you know, a vote. You know, the vast majority of the American public is not going to side with hunters. So you've got to find something in between, and that's some kind of collaborative model.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think, and I'm pulling this to one of the solutions I saw that you guys had there, is the public trust doctrine. Is this something that, well, describe what that means too for everybody who's listening, but do you think that's a tool that can be used in terms of finding this middle ground or radical middle, as a lot of the people we've spoken to have said that it's, again, you're not going to get everything that you want, but most of what everybody needs will be met.
Yeah, I think it's a key piece of the puzzle. So the public trust doctrine it's a legal doctrine. It's codified in various state laws, state by state. It's sometimes really rooted in water, which is a common resource that's kind of challenged other forms of governance that's required this sort of thinking about I referenced the tragedy of the commons. So to avoid the tragedy of the commons, we've come up with this public trust doctrine. And its roots are going all the way back into common law. But basically it holds that nature, and we argue that includes wildlife, is a public trust that the government has a fiduciary duty to protect for the benefit of beneficiaries. So those beneficiaries can be humans and non-humans both. It could be, you know, protecting nature for nature is still a fiduciary responsibility for beneficiaries. And, you know, fiduciary, again, you get into these wonky legal terms really quickly when you start talking about public trust doctrine. But fiduciary is just a legal term that means there's a duty to appropriately and prudently manage and preserve. You know, and lots of times people think about a trust as a pot of money that you pass on to your children, right? But a trust can be lots of things. So it's a key piece of the puzzle. If I think particularly if we recognize that nature has its own stake in this game, isn't just managed for human beneficiaries.
I'm known for throwing out wild card questions in these podcasts. I assume everybody knows that by now. But is there a reality in wildlife management in which there doesn't have to be anti-hunting? This is just a hypothetical. Doesn't have to be killing of wild animals? Not because is wildlife management in some way, it's not synonymous, but is participating in what we call the circle of life, life and death? Is that important for us as a species, being that there's so much of the planet? Is that inevitably part of wildlife management, whether folks like hunting or not, whether the hunting tradition goes down the drain or not? I think there to some degree will have to be, there will always have to be, we will always have to participate in what we might call the circle of life. Regardless of whether it's hunting or another means, or we're paying for it as taxpayers. And I think, isn't it a little bit of a misconception that we can happily get rid of the hunting tradition and then therefore no animals will have to die?
Such a good question. There are some philosophers, one particular scholar that comes to mind is Paul Shepard, who wrote this book, The Others. And he makes that argument that, you know, to pull ourselves out, to pull ourselves out of the system,
right,
should be questioned and maybe is problematic for our species who have been opportunistic omnivores. So, you know, I'm vegan at home, so I'll just put that out there. And, you know, from my perspective and the perspective of other philosophers that have argued for veganism, you know, our species doesn't need to eat meat, right? So there's the question of, you know, what's justified and moral, and do we have alternatives? And not everybody has the same access to meat alternatives as other people. That will change and come. But there still is, I think, a valid argument, at least for some people, they feel that connection to nature through hunting. And another social science researcher, Stephen Keller, did a lot of work trying to understand the different kinds of hunters. And there are nature hunters who feel that sometimes they don't ever take a deer. They walk through the woods with a gun and they never get the opportunity that they wanted, but that's still their connection to nature. And for some, it is actually putting protein on the table, protein especially that didn't come from industrial animal agriculture. So there are definitely valid reasons for maintaining the hunt. And I'm so glad you brought it up, because that's something that we get accused of all the time at Wildlife for All and other, you know, places that I've been, that, you know, we're anti-hunting and they offer this slippery slope argument. But I counter that, you know, a slippery slope argument is really just a logical fallacy, referencing a kind of logical fallacy that, you know, you can't make any argument, because you could say, oh, it's always going to lead to something else. But, you know, saying that there's no justification for wildlife killing contests or for killing wolves, especially recreationally, is different than saying you shouldn't hunt a elk or deer to put meat on the Thanksgiving table. Those are very different. And, you know, I, for one, am never going to make that argument against that.
Right.
So it's such a good point.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely valid. And I think it's something that we've, as Stephen mentioned before, that we've really kept the door open so that we hear all these different sides, both sides or multiple sides, whatever it is, because they're, like you said, Michelle, there's no way I think and we've spoken with hunters who are sustenance hunters. They go out, they get their elk or their deer or two deer, whatever it takes. And that's their pull for the year. I think, like you say, where we get into these slippery slopes are these killing contests that you see across the, it's not just in the West, it's all across the country. You know, some in Maine.
The word contest should never be associated with killing anything. I just think that's like really.
Exactly. And I think that was one thing that was really hammered home when I spoke to Dave Stalling about that, where he, again, when you get into these issues where when they have posters up saying, how many coyotes can you kill? Or how many muskrats are going, it's like, this is not what we are on this planet to do. And it's really, I mean, where do you think, cause when you go through the sociology aspects of it or the ecological aspects of it, Michelle, and cause you guys, I'm sure you guys have all this research behind it. Where do you think, in your opinion, if you can, where the human species sort of lost this connection from we're going to hunt and kill for our survival and got to the point where we are doing it for sport and recreation on a scale that it frankly is somewhat sickening that we, like you say, you have the fact that we have to ban contests or any sort of killing in that manner in multitudes. Why do you think, or if you can, where do you think it was kind of lost along the way?
I thought a lot about this question. And so this is a lot of speculation, but I think there are a couple different patterns that are contributing to this shift. So hunting used to be a common tradition and people put food on the table with it, right? You know, it's sort of both in terms of the kind of American pioneer spirit, but also in tribal traditions. Obviously, that was a huge part of to nature and still are. But that got lost. And, you know, as I noted earlier, only 4.6% of Americans hunt. And that used to be a lot higher. So while we're losing the tradition where it was not just men, but predominantly a male informed tradition, you know, fathers were teaching their children, their sons to hunt. Aldo Leopold talks about his own father's, you know, even when there wasn't a bag limit, you followed your own personal bag limit or a social norm around what would be appropriate, how many ducks to take. People followed that. And that was a tradition that got passed on. As that died and went away and we moved to cities and we lost our connections to those sort of traditions and to nature generally, you know, that's one way that we've lost the informed ethics and social the hunting tradition ethical, right? And then at the same time, you still have people who want to, you know, it's ego-driven now. And I'm not anti-technology, but the technology around weapons increased and made it, and some people want to connect it to video games. I don't know if that's the case or not. I don't know that that's even important, but we've weaponized ourselves as a society to the point where I think a lot of people, and I'm just going to say it, it's like a masculine thing, to tie powered machinery, go around on ATVs in the middle of the night with thermal imaging and scopes and be able to smoke a bunch of coyotes or foxes from a football field away. And that's a way to show status. And again, I'm not saying it's all men, women partake in this, but it is still very male dominated. And I think it also is for some people associated with this very like pro-military perspective. So they see folks in Afghanistan using these high powered rifles and they get to do it in their own backyards. These weapons are highly available. So there's that, and that's particularly around, I've thought about this with wildlife killing contests and the journalists that embed themselves in these contests, and you see what they're doing and the technology that they're using. It's just not sporting. It's so far away from what hunting was a couple decades ago. And it's not the same people participating in it. So while you have that dying tradition, you have this new kind of militarized perspective growing and access to these weapons that is just kind of pretty alarming.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. It's pretty obvious noticing the military parallels in hunting marketing these days. I feel like I listened to a podcast that mentioned the sort of modern hunter mentality, not necessarily regulations, but just the mentality of modern hunting. A sort of historical point of interest might be after guys came home from war and turned to hunting as a time. But I don't know the exact history. But yeah, I think the part of this is just, it just boils down simply to, like you were saying, technology, right? But also, comfort. I think we underestimate how different our lives are now compared to 100 years ago in terms of comfort and use of time, just to do this and live in enough comfort to consider something that was once an absolute necessity as simply sport is, I think, causing a bit of an issue and a disconnect. And this change in time and comfort, I think, plays a role in all sorts of human behavioral changes, just how we use our intelligence. And I think definitely location plays a part, locations of just our cities, in that many people, not everyone, but many people, if they connect to nature through hunting, they're not necessarily connected to the natural world in their everyday life, in their lifestyle. And maybe that is part of our modern disconnect.
Absolutely. I think we're all, I can speak for myself. I contribute to it as well. We're all starting to live this life where everything's so busy and full. How often do you get out and go to the same place and see it change through the seasons and observe? Yeah. We're just not doing that. And so that's, I think, a call for everybody to try and check back in and put the phone down.
Yeah. It's hard to remind yourself that you're an animal and that you have to be connected to the rhythms of, the planet, because we can just be in our houses. We don't migrate anymore, so we don't have that connection with the seasons. The reason it sucks to be in 118 degrees is because we're not supposed to be. We're supposed to be migrating somewhere cooler. And the reason it sucks for it to be minus 50 is because we're not supposed to be in it. We're supposed to be migrating, right? So we have this like disconnect with the natural world, but then a lot of people still have that feeling, that primal feeling to meet and not to necessarily buy it at the store. So I understand all that. It's complicated, man, but interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And again, just a plug for democracy and considering everybody's interests and, having these conversations and reaching outside of your identity group and your comfort zones and having people who are not like-minded, super helpful. Yeah. And that's, that's a broad, that speaks to the broader partisan conflict that's happening right now. I mean, some scholars are saying we're in a kind of civil war, essentially, in terms of the way we've divided ourselves. And, it applies to wolf conservation, and it applies to all kinds of wildlife governance, and it applies to the political fights that we're in. We protect ourselves by self-aggregating into the states that we live in, the neighborhoods that we live in, the t-shirts that we wear, the bumper stickers, the flags that we fly in our yard, right? And the coffee shops to, populated by like minds. We're doing that on such a level that it creates extreme polarity. And then it also creates this thing called the black sheep effect, where if someone within your identity group doesn't toe the party line, you harsh, you know, you judge them harshly. And so no one's allowed to say something that's not in line with, you know, what the identity group says is okay. And that's, you know, that's dangerous too. So again, collaboration and conversation, we're going to have to get better at doing that. I think about, it's almost like you really got to take an approach of relationship advice and apply that to your work. I'm like always constantly like count to 10, active listen, use I statements, you know, because it's hard, you know, but we all got to do it.
Yeah, you have to be a psychologist now.
Exactly.
You have to be a psychologist to survive now. But it's because it's a slippery slope these days because we're so had someone go through every item you own and what it's made of and how it affects oceans or what happens when you wash your clothes or what happens when you're using Tupperware. Or, I mean, you'd have a heart attack. You'd just be you'd have so much anxiety about how much impact you're having to the planet unconsciously, and it's slope to judge everyone these days because and not to want that sense of collaboration because everything has holes in it and there's nothing. I mean, we're all wearing some form of plastic right now and it's being flushed down the drain and into the water and it's affecting every we're affecting everything all the time. And man, it's a really wild time. But you got to be a psychologist just to go walk out the door these days. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I lose my mind thinking about like, well, the tofu I'm buying is contributing to rainforest, it's you know, just loss in the Amazon. And, you know, you.
Oh my God.
Yeah, you
crisis.
Can't win.
Just say crisis 100 times.
Oh, so that's why the path of, I mean, well, the path of most productive behavior is to collaborate because you can't win.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, we got to take care of each other better. Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild. It really, because if we don't do that, it's, man, everything you guys are saying. It's just, to be fair, Stephen, you have this moment, I think every time, because you get into a point where you just like, we've talked about this 100 times. I don't know how we can fix it. It's just like, I'm not being mean to you, but it's just like, but you're right. It's so mind numbing to think that we've gotten ourselves in this situation where
it's a pickle, man.
It is. Yeah. It is. We're like jammed in a pickle jar big time, pal. And it's just, it's like, what do we do? And we say this stuff all the time though, because it's never, again, the three of us could sit here and we're talking about this. I can guarantee there is a wolf out there living its life and not knowing anything, just eating, just laying down, rolling, doing whatever, sitting in the shade. They don't care. And it's just when you put it down, I don't know if it was, I don't know which podcast it was. I think I said something to the effect that we have overcomplicated everything. And when you look at it, it is just as simple as if you just looked at the animals that either you were hunting who are prey or predators that you dislike in some way or that you go and watch, they are literally living the life that we used to live not that long ago. And if we get back to those core things, we are all
just the values.
Yeah, just the core values. Yeah. We're all very similar, probably more similar than we want to, I think, than we care to admit. And that's the scary part, is that people don't want to believe that we are all on this planet to do one thing or another. And yes, we get busy and yes, we have this and yes, we have that and technology and this and that, the other thing. But boy, if you get down to the core, like three or four things that we need to do to survive, we're pretty much all in the same boat. And that's when you equate it to the animals that you are viewing, that you're hunting, that you dislike. I don't know. I think that's more, I think to what Michelle, you've said the whole time we've talking, I think we would get to more common ground if we were in that state more often. And Stephen, to what you were saying.
Yeah. And I think the greatest common ground we can all find is the idea that we're being governed by larger bodies of people than we think we do, really. I mean, everything is so complex. There are nuances beyond belief to these processes and differences we are, you know, we find ourselves attacking each other over, that really never come to a resting place because there's more than we think there is to it. In my mind, it's really now, in this time and place particularly, to be on a high horse. And it's really silly to be attacking each other when we really do have a common issue, which is the entire system of how we're being governed and how resources are being used. And again, it's really sort of asinine other for different ways of life when being different is definitely not the issue.
I mean, we have some common enemies, you know, the powers that be that will sell life to the highest bidder that are resulting in, you know, forever chemicals in your kale. I already didn't like kale. And then I heard that and I was like, all right, that's out, you know, but yeah, it's never in deep ocean and in our guts, right? You know, this is all a result of late stage capitalism is not serving anybody very well, except for a very powerful few.
What a world it would be if we all coalesced together. And seriously, think about it. If you think about on the wolf issue, if you had every form of human fighting for correct conservation and state wildlife management just for wolves, the power that would hold, it would trickle down to everything else. Because then you just go, oh no, we feel the same way about bears. Oh no, we feel the same way about mountain lions. Oh no, we feel the same way about our elk and our mule deer and chronic wasting disease. No, we feel all this. So anyway, it's just-
Yeah, we want it to work for everyone. This is the
exactly.
point.
Exactly,
you know?
100%. Michelle, where can people find Wildlife for All, the policies that you guys are trying to enact, all the work that you guys are doing? Again, I know it's not beginning stages, but you're starting to get your feet under you. Where can we go and look? How can people help? What's the best way for them to contact you or anybody else?
Thanks for asking. Yeah. So start with our website, Wildlife for Us. It's chock full of information that really makes it, I think, accessible and digestible. So public trust doctrine might sound really wonky, but our website explains it in a really clear way. There's also this Find Your State feature, which summarizes what's going on in your state. You know, so many commissioners and the legislature has to approve those, you know, those sort of details that are really important to start getting involved. And then we've got lots of actions that you can take in terms of starting to get involved in your wildlife commissions and all kinds of wildlife policy that's being set. So those are the first steps, Wildlife for All. And we're also on social media. We're on all the regular platforms from LinkedIn to Facebook and Instagram. And info@wildlifeforall.us is a good place to reach both Kevin and I.
Terrific. Highly recommend all of you visiting the website and emailing them, because they are, again, just the fact that Michelle and Kevin are co-EDs. Dave Stalling is on the advisor. I mean, they have a lot of, I know I'm just naming you three, but there are a lot of very informative people there that can help direct you in any way that you want to do. Michelle, now that we have you solo, I'll ask you this. When you hear the word wolf, what's the thing that comes to your mind?
Oh gosh, such a good question. I think you asked me last time. I should have been prepared. Fierceness. And that maybe that's what I said last time, but fierce defense of life and family and the way of life that they believe in. And that's what inspires me to wolves and all wildlife.
Yeah. I mean, it shows through in everything. We can't have a better person there. Michelle Lute, thank you so much for your time, for all of your effort. You are a truly shining beacon in all of the muddiness and the crisis, as many times as you say it, but you're incredible. So thank you for spending time with Stephen and I again. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And likewise, thanks for all your good work.
Absolutely. Stick around for just a minute. Howls to all you out there, and Stephen, I'll be with you next time. Bye, everybody. Looking for more information about Wolf Connection or the podcast? Please visit our website at wolfconnection.org, where you can donate, sponsor a wolf, or become a volunteer.